the Underdog Podcast from SB Nation and Underdog Dynasty.
Welcome back to another episode of the Conference USA Underdog Podcast here on UnderdogDynasty.com, SB Nation's home for G5 football. Excited to get into it with my good buddy Eric Henry today. Lots of coaching changes within CUSA as the offseason usually dictates. A little bit chaotic out there. We're here to try and help make sense of it. Joe Londergan here with you. And like I mentioned, Eric Henry, how are you doing today, buddy?
I am doing okay, man. I am in the midst of the post-Gasparilla festivities recovery, which usually takes about a week. And at the age that you and I are at, it takes a little bit longer to recover from those old hangovers. So, but I'm doing all right. Outside of that, I can't complain, my man. How are you?
Good. That is the worst part about getting older, by the way, is how long it takes you to shake a hangover. Like, it's just getting – extremely inconvenient how much Pedialyte you actually have to get into your system to soak up all for one night of drinking. But I'm okay. As we were talking about beforehand, I got a little bit of a cough, and the reason why I picked it up is stupid. So I'm in Fort Myers, Florida at the moment visiting my parents, and I flew from Portland and connected in Detroit. When we landed, I had to run from gate A2 to gate A60 to try and make my flight in a matter of about 8 minutes. And here's the thing. I'm extremely out of shape. So sprinting that full thing, the sweat I worked up combined with how hard it was, how much difficulty I was having breathing and coughing, I got into the plane and multiple flight attendants came out to me and said, "Sir, do you have to deplane? Are you sure you don't have the flu?" Which, of course, referring to the coronavirus. And me, humiliated, had to explain, "No, I'm just extremely fat. I apologize."
That is the worst feeling. I had no idea Detroit was that bad of an airport. Being here in the central part of Florida, as you're still in Lee County, beautiful Southwest Florida. Mm-hmm. I tend to take a lot of connecting flights that end up in Atlanta, and anyone who's flown into Hartsfield knows that it is a massive airport that is known for putting you at like gate A1, as you said. Your connection will be at gate 889, and you'll have 3.5 minutes to make it. So I didn't know Detroit was that bad, but I would have thought being down there in the beautiful beach area down there would have cleared you up a little bit. But the weather hasn't actually been that great down here, so probably haven't spent much time outside.
Not yet, no. But yeah, the weather's not great. And dude, I was pushing strollers out of the way. I was causing havoc on the moving sidewalks. It was bad. And God can only hope they burned that seat I sat in. I was sweating that bad. But anyway, yeah, so that's been my world recently. A little chaotic, which is kind of, indicative of the nature of CUSA football, as we kind of discussed with all the coaching changes happening. Let's start off with one impacting the Louisiana Tech Bulldogs. They signed David Blackwell as their new defensive coordinator, who was formerly the defensive coordinator at Old Dominion previously, actually. For those that don't remember, Tech just lost Bob Diaco to Purdue for that DC job. And personally, I think this is a pretty decent hire for them, solely because he knows the conference well and knows the kind of schemes they're going to have to deal with on the other side of the ball. So I think, like, while he probably wasn't, like, the greatest candidate out there just in terms of coaching pedigree, I think if you're going to get somebody who has that advantage and has knowledge of the teams that you're going to face every week, I think that's certainly not the worst way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons I really want to spotlight this coaching change in particular is you got to remember, I think Bob Diaco tends to get a little bit, or maybe I just hear a ton of it being a UCF alum, and we all know the ill-fated civil conflict rivalry that he tried to start up, but he tends to get a little bit of that, for lack of a better term, stink from that tenure at UConn, in which we know that UConn program has really kind of suffered over the past really five, six, 7 years, past half a decade or so. But he was a really good defensive coordinator. I mean, going back to his time at Cincinnati, Notre Dame, he actually won the Broyles Award in 2012, which is given to the nation's top assistant. So the fact that he spent that time at Louisiana Tech, I remember when he came in from Oklahoma, he was the linebackers coach at Oklahoma in 2018. And when Skip Holtz got him in 2019, I thought that was a really good hire because the guy, you know, his head coaching tenure obviously didn't work out great, but he's kind of like that, you know, the maybe the college version, and he's young enough where he'll get another opportunity, but maybe he's the college version of, you know, a Wade Phillips or the Ryan brothers, who are, or maybe even a Jason Garrett, who aren't the best head coaches, but as coordinators, you know, they're proven commodities. Now, to bring it around to David Blackwell coming in, I thought that was a solid hire. Like you mentioned, you know, maybe not the most flashy name in the world, maybe not, you know, that doesn't have the same name cachet and pedigree as Bob Diaco. But if you look back at his time, he actually took the defensive coordinator job, and he was the defensive coordinator at Old Dominion this past year. When you look at ODU, I know you look at him on paper and say, oh man, if you're a Tech fan, you're thinking, we got ODU's former defensive coordinator, this isn't good. But I think as anyone who saw ODU play this year, the amount of time that defense spent on the field was just, you know, damn near inhumane with how, you know, and you and I have talked about it on the pod, you know, how poor the Old Dominion offense looked really until the time that Hayden Wolf took over at quarterback, was able to move the football. So they spent a lot of time out there on defense trying to defend. So if you look at the numbers per se, it might not look great, but even for their record, Joe, something that I had to go back and look up, they were sixth in run defense and seventh in pass defense. So they were a mid-range Conference USA team in terms of stopping those opposing offenses, considering the fact that they spent a ton of time out there on defense. You know, the scoring defense, I believe, was ninth or 10th, and that's just going to come as a factor of having to defend so many drives. But all in all, I don't think you can complain. There's a lot of defensive talent there. You got guys like Willie Baker and others on the on Louisiana Tech defense. So I think they'll be okay.
Yeah, I think, like I said, this is definitely a step in a positive direction for them, all things considered. And, you know, like you mentioned, Bob Diaco did such a good job. It's hard to follow up, you know, with someone who you would expect to immediately, you know, just kind of pick up where he left off. But I think Blackwell, you know, can do some good things, maybe not have them competing at that level that they were right away. But I think, you know, for the long term, I think this is a good move for Tech. Switching to the offensive side of the ball, and switching to the other side of the conference, actually, Charlotte, I think a lot of people were really positively surprised by what they were able to do, especially on the offensive side of the ball with the performance of Chris Reynolds and Benny LeMay. But next season looks like they are going to have a different offensive coordinator in Mark Carney. 49er fans know that name because he was their quarterback's coach last season. And a lot of people give him credit for the great season that Chris Reynolds had and the offensive turnaround subsequently. So I think this is a good one for him. And I think it's also kind of poetic that Carney, I believe, was actually Will Healy's quarterback coach when Healy was a player at the University of Richmond. So interesting that it's staying in the family, so to speak. And, you know, I think if you're Charlotte, you would most likely want a guy who is familiar with the system that won you so many ball games since Will Healy's come on. And it's good that they're, you know, getting that in Carney here.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I kind of go into kind of my analysis of this, I'll just pose this question to you. I think you and I both would agree on this one, that probably the most crucial thing for Charlotte's offense in 2020, and yes, they'll have to replace Benny LeMay. You know, Benny is, anyone who's listened to this podcast knows how I feel about Benny. And I thought, you know, he was arguably the best running back in Conference USA over the past 2 years. But I think you and I would agree that for Charlotte going forward, the number one concern for them really has to be, especially with LeMay being gone, is Chris Reynolds taking the next step as a quarterback. We saw little flashes in 2018 before he broke his leg. He took the next step this year in 2019 and looked like a really good quarterback. But I think you would agree that in 2020, especially with the absence of the run game or an established run game, we don't know how Trey Harbison, who was a former 1,000-yard rusher at Northern Illinois, how he'll fit in immediately. So probably the number one thing for them in the offseason is to really keep the development of Chris Reynolds. You would agree with that, right?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair statement. It's definitely going to be a lot to replace with Ben LeMay. But, you know, I think if you have a competent quarterback like we've described Chris Reynolds as, I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. And you have someone who is familiar with his play style and knows what his strengths are, what his weaknesses are, and can kind of, you know, design the, you know, offensive game plans around that.
Right. So that's the first aspect I want to take, is that I think keeping that continuity, someone who Chris Reynolds is familiar with, I thought that the worst thing that could come in, and I'm not saying that Will Healy would have done this, but I think the worst thing that could have happened was maybe bringing an outside voice, who's someone who you kind of have to start the entire process of getting to know them. And, you know, we know that that quarterback offensive coordinator relationship can be really unique and special. Obviously, we had James Morgan on in our last episode, and he talked about what FIU offensive coordinator Rich Kroski will do for his career. So that can be unique. I think that the second angle about this that's really key is that, and maybe this is just me, you know, it's the journalist in me maybe, but I think that with Will Healy being a younger coach, I believe Will Healy is now 35 or 36 years of age, you really want to keep that level of continuity in terms of someone you know and someone that you trust. Because if you bring in a veteran guy, and obviously this is, you know, more likely to happen at the pro level than in college, but I think if you bring in someone who has been an offensive coordinator for, you know, two decades and has all this experience, and maybe they might look at Will Healy and say, dude, I've been doing this longer than, you know, I've been doing this since you were in high school. Who are you to question me? And I just don't think you want to create that type of environment around the program. So I think keeping that continuity, especially with someone that he knows and is familiar with, is also key.
Yeah, certainly seems to be so just historically when it comes to college football. So, you know, like we both said, it's definitely a step in the right direction for this program. So we'll see how they can continue to develop as an offense down the road. And now let's talk about some changes at FAU. You know, a lot of transition there with Willie Taggart taking over the head coaching position. And on the offensive side of the ball, they're adding another little wrinkle to it with the addition of Drew Maringer, former pass game coordinator at the University of Texas. He comes to FAU, and he's now the co-offensive coordinator and wide receivers coach of the Owls. So just with Maringer in particular, I think you've kind of seen that Texas's pass game, you know, with the kind of level of inconsistency that program's had over the last few years or so, I think the quarterback play in the passing game has been one of the highlights, definitely. So for the FAU fans, you might be wondering, how does, you know, what's going on with DJ McCarthy? Well, he is now at FIU, which we'll talk about in a little bit. He has a son, Guy, who is a freshman at FAU. And because of this coaching change taking place, we don't know how that's going to affect, you know, his future going forward. Is he going to stay at FAU? Is he going to transfer to FIU with his dad? So we'll see. But as far as the hire of Drew Maringer goes, I think this is going to be, you know, it should be a decent pickup for them to bring him in alongside Clint Trickett to be the co-offensive coordinator, based on the results that he had at Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I'm kind of interested in here is, and I'll ask your POV on this, the trend of young offensive coordinators. I don't really have an issue with it. I know, you know, and we can get into an entire sociological discussion about, you know, how coaches get their jobs and things of that nature. You know, I'll just save that for the podcast. But just overall as a whole, I don't mind the trend of younger guys who are 25, 26, 27. So I think they can relate to players. Now, as someone who I tend to talk to on a very regular basis, the head ball coach down at FIU will be quick to correct me and say, hey, you know, I've been relating to players for 40 years. So don't, you know, don't just put me out the pasture and say it's an age thing. So I apologize, Coach Davis. But no, I just think that, you know, I think the younger coaches, I think it works. I think that especially when you got a guy like, you know, Chris Robinson, I think there's just a certain familiarity about, you know, maybe, you know, I think the older coaches can provide that veteran experience. And obviously it goes from player to player, and it's not, you know, homogenous. It's not one way around. But I think in this scenario, and especially with it being the co-offensive coordinator position, and we talked about Maringer, he has previous offensive coordinator experience at Rutgers. I just think it'll work really well with, you know, Chris Robinson. It's one of those things that you and I have talked about before. Just don't rock the boat. You know, we know the talent that he has. He really took that next step as a quarterback. So just kind of get someone who, and I genuinely mean this as a compliment. I do not mean this as an insult. You know, you kind of want to get someone who can kind of be that big brother sense, you know, not be that authoritarian, you know, just consistently kind of coming down on someone. So I think that's a good situation there. And yeah, I mean, we talked about the fact that, or you mentioned it, that Texas's pass game wasn't necessarily great, but I think it's a different circumstance. We know what FAU has in Robinson. And yes, they are losing some talent at receiver, but I just think that overall, you know, the co-offensive coordinator thing, I think will work really well with him and Clint Trickett. And I just like the dynamic of Brent. So I think it's a good hire. And you did mention the fact as well that DJ McCarthy has, you know, made that transition to FIU. It'll be interesting to see what his son does as well. But, you know, Maringer will also provide that wide receivers role coach. So, you know, I think all in all, it'll be a good hire for FAU.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll add to your thoughts on the whole young offensive coordinator versus old offensive coordinator debate, I guess. I think it can definitely work both ways. You know, you've seen it work both ways at every level of football, so to speak. But, yeah, I do think there is something to having younger coaches who, you know, just experienced their playing days more recently and can kind of relate a little bit more to specifically like what, you know, these guys go through in terms of, you know, balancing like ego in particular with their roles on as a quarterback, and all those different things, which is why, you know, I think Clint Trickett's had the success he's had because injuries kind of, you know, unfortunately shortened his career a little bit, but since he jumped right into coaching, he knew what all these guys were dealing with immediately. And I think that's kind of why he was able to build the relationships that he's had. And it seems like Drew Maringer's kind of had, you know, similar fortune in relating to players and getting them to perform at a high level. So yeah, I definitely am curious to see how these guys work together since they've had, you know, since they're both young offensive coordinators still kind of approaching their prime, so to speak. So it should be interesting. And we talked a little bit about FIU in that last little rant there, but definitely a lot of coaching changes to kind of go through. And for more on that, I will happily defer to, I would say, the foremost FIU football expert in the college football space at the moment. Eric, do you want to enlighten the people on what's going on over there in Miami?
Man, big praise, Joe. I mean, I'll take it. That's you know, I appreciate it, buddy. As far as FIU goes, you know, the last thing that Butch Davis said to me before he walked off the podium at the Camellia Bowl after their loss, you know, a disappointing year in which they finished 6-7, was he said, you know, Eric, there's going to be a hell of a lot of changes in the way we do things so that we're a more disciplined and complete football team. And he ended his press conference with that. You don't necessarily know how much of that is manifesting these changes, but there has been some significant coaching turnover, that being at the offensive line spot. You know, one of the things, I mean, Alan Mogridge is regarded as one of the better offensive line coaches in the country. And to be honest, just to be quite frank with, you know, the listeners here, I won't have a chance to talk to Butch Davis until Wednesday, which will actually be National Signing Day. And I'll be in Miami and he'll have a press conference. So that'll be the first time that he'll address the coaching changes. So I don't know whether Coach Mogridge left on his own accord or whether it's just a mutual parting of the ways. I don't think there's any bad blood there or anything like that. I mean, Alan Mogridge is a guy who worked for Butch Davis in North Carolina, and they have, you know, a really good working relationship. Coach Davis has spoke glowingly of him, as a matter of fact, making him the assistant head coach during his first 3 years there. So I'd be interested to see what he has to say about that, but I don't think that was anything where, you know, maybe Mogridge was dismissed. Maybe they just felt it was, you know, a need for a change in scenery and change of voice both ways. And then also at the special teams coach position, James Villano was not retained as the special teams coach. Once again, don't have any specifics on that without having talked to Butch Davis since December, middle of December. Wow, it's actually been about a month or a month and change since the last time I talked to him. So we'll have to get the info on that. But in their place, the first one is going to be Joel Rodriguez, who is the offensive line coach now for FIU. Kind of a unique hire. Speaking of guys who I know you'd mentioned that, Will Healy, the offensive coordinator there, is actually someone who Will Healy played under. Joel Rodriguez is someone who Butch Davis recruited to the University of Miami. He's a former University of Miami center, played there from 2000 to 2004. So obviously that's kind of where the relationship was struck there. And he's coming off a tenure in which he spent 3 years as an offensive analyst for the Hurricanes. Prior to that, he does have some offensive line coaching experience at the lower level FCS with Bryant and another FCS school that I'm escaping off the top of my head. So he'll kind of come in there. I believe he's 37 or 38 years old. So, I mean, that math does line up, you know, a graduate in 04. So that math is about right. So definitely another younger voice coming in, similar age to Alan Mogridge as well. So I think that'll be a solid hire. It'll be unique to see what he does at this level with this being his first on-field coaching role at, you know, the FCS, at the FBS level, as opposed to being an analyst earlier at Miami. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. It'll look like he's hit the ground running. And then the second one we talked about is DJ McCarthy. And that's a unique hire. I think he's going to bring a veteran voice. You know, not that James Villano, by any stretch of imagination, wasn't a good special teams coach. You know, guys like Jose Borregales and a lot of the special teams guys were really close with him. But what McCarthy brings is NFL experience, having coached with the Oakland Raiders, I believe the Minnesota Vikings as well. And he's also coached at some really big stops. You know, he spent some time at Central Florida, also spent some time at some Power 5 schools. So I think that is going to be a really unique situation in which FIU, if we look at their coaching staff as a whole, and this isn't to say, once again, that you need that quote-unquote veteran voice, but they have a lot of guys who are either younger or in kind of the almost the infancy of their coaching journey. You know, you look at the tight ends coaches, Drew Davis, who was Butch Davis' son. This will be his fourth year coaching overall, I believe. You look at Bryn Renner, who's there as the cornerbacks coach. This will be his second year as a collegiate coach. Prior to that, he was solely the recruiting coordinator for FIU. Look at Tim Harris Jr., who was a successful high school coach, but is in his third or fourth year. I believe this would be his fourth year as a running backs coach. So a lot of guys kind of in their coaching infancy. So to kind of bring us a veteran like DJ McCarthy, I think that'll be a good hire as well.
Nice. So I think going back to the kind of special team stuff that you were talking about before and the fact that they didn't retain their special teams coordinator, you know, we're purely speculating at this point. Do you think that had anything to do with the fact fact that Jose Borregales ended up transferring to UM and, you know, didn't want to be part of that program anymore?
I think it would be naive of us to act like it didn't have anything to do with it. I hope that all of our listeners had a chance to check out the Q&A, the interview I did with Jose the day he actually made the decision to leave. One of the things he said, and the quote I felt was kind of misconstrued by some FIU fans, they took it as if James Villano had some sort of influence in him leaving. And it wasn't that as much as he and Jose are very tight. You know, I would venture to say they have like a father-son relationship. And Villano said, I don't want to misquote him, but Villano said that his dad told him when Jose said, you know, if you're in my shoes, what would you do? And his dad told him that if you feel like you've accomplished everything in one spot, that you kind of have to move on. And, you know, so there's no doubt that Villano, whether directly or indirectly, influenced his decision to transfer. Now, whether that was the only factor in it, I think that would be incorrect to say, because Jose talked about in that interview, and quite frankly, a ton of interviews, that being a born and raised Miamian, it was always his dream to play for the Hurricanes. And a lot of players I've spoken to over the past, you know, month and a half, whether it be he or Stanley Thomas Oliver, Austin Maloney, they've spoken about how, you know, and this isn't a swipe at FIU fans, because there's a lot of diehard, faithful FIU fans. But the fact of the matter is this, they're not playing in front of a packed house with a cage. So Borregales mentioned just the opportunity to kick on the biggest stage was something that appealed to him. So to answer your question, I think it's 50-50. You know, I don't think Villano directly influenced his decision to leave, but there definitely was a factor in their conversation just by the nature of how tight the relationship is.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. I mean, there's tons of different factors that can go into these kind of decisions for keeping coaches and or versus retaining them and that sort of thing. So, you know, we can't say anything's a fact definitively, but, you know, moving forward, the coaching staff is going to be different at FIU, and so is the roster. So that's just kind of the reality of the situation, but definitely more coaching changes within the league to get to. So let's jump over to the great state of Texas, where you'll remember the University of North Texas had a little bit of a disappointing year, and as a result, Coach Seth Luttrell decided, let's get all new offensive and defensive coordinators. Already have co-offensive coordinator Tommy Raynard, who's also the receivers coach. Looks like they found their other co-offensive coordinator in Mr. Mike Blausch. And he is, of course, a native Texan. He returns to his home state to be the co-offensive coordinator and the offensive line coach for the Mean Green. He spent the last five seasons as an assistant at Tulsa. And folks within the state of Texas will remember him as a Houston Cougar, where he played from 2006 through 2008. So yeah, I think if you have someone like Reynard who, you know, knows kind of the ins and outs of the pass game, and you have somebody who like Blausch, who's an offensive line guy and probably knows the ins and outs of the run game a little bit more, I feel like that's a pretty good combo. And, you know, it definitely helps to have somebody like Blausch who knows the state of Texas, and that'll obviously help in recruiting a little bit, somewhat, I would think. But I like that hire a lot, actually. Not that I really had much doubt in who Seth Luttrell would bring in, because he definitely made it clear he means business after the way last season went. Excuse me. But I think that's a great step in the right direction for North Texas.
No, yeah, absolutely. I think one of those things, and it's funny you talk about Seth Luttrell meaning business. You know, I'm not trying to make myself out to be, you know, like some big tough guy, but, you know, I'm not normally intimidated or anything by, you know, talking to coaches. I mean, most coaches, you know, we've all played football at some level, you know, coaches are coaches, but man, Seth Luttrell just walks around, and I don't mean it says he's a mean guy, but he just has that, you know, that serious, intense look when you see him. And it's also probably the fact that he looks like he could be an NFL linebacker right now. He's still in shape.
So I was going to say, he looks like a Terminator. Yeah, he looks like a T-800.
Yeah, he just is built like a big, sturdy, you know, Texas linebacker down there. But no, I always say that is to say that I no one's going to really doubt Seth Luttrell in terms of his offensive, you know, prowess. And obviously things didn't go the way they want to this year as far as Mason Fine's last year. And I think it'll be interesting to see, because I think that Seth Luttrell, I don't want to say he has any regrets, but I think that you'll see more of an imprint as far as his hand in the play calling per se, especially with the younger quarterbacks coming in, because we know they're moving on from Mason Fine and it's going to be a younger guy behind center. But I think this move, you know, this is going to be a combo thing. You know, you're going to have Luttrell's imprint. You're going to have Mike Blosch's imprint as well. So I think it's a good, solid move. Once again, you talk about him having those Texas roots. I think that helps a lot. So all in all, I think the offensive side of the ball is one that I'm not too concerned about, just because they have that track record and they have talent there. It's really the coaching change at the defensive side of the ball, which I know you'll get to in a second, that I think that's the one that really, if you're a North Texas fan, that's the one you really got to pay attention to.
On the defensive side of the ball, North Texas bringing back a familiar face in Clint Bowen. He actually held at the beginning of the decade the same job, the defensive coordinator at the University of North Texas. He spent the better part of this past decade as the defensive coordinator at Kansas. So we talked about Blausch having familiarity with the state of Texas. Obviously, Bowen does too. So I feel like that's also a, you know, pretty decent step in the direction. I feel like it's a step in a positive direction for the North Texas defense as well. Didn't have great results at Kansas. Obviously, that team saw a few different head coaches come in over the last 10 years or so. But, you know, I think anytime you can kind of bring in who's familiar with the university, knows, you know, the history of the program, I think that's always good. But I'm less enthused about this hire, I guess, but I still don't think it's a bad hire per se.
Yeah, I mean, it's one, and I kind of agree with you. It's not, you know, a knock your socks off type hire, especially, if you're a North Texas fan, you're probably wondering, you know, damn, we've had defensive struggles that have only gotten worse. You know, really, I think that their struggles were really kind of, you know, overshadowed by the fact that Mason Fine and that prolific offense kind of, they were a band-aid. You know, they definitely outscored teams. It wasn't a situation in which they were winning games 45-10. You know, a lot of their wins probably came, you know, 50-35, 50-38, things of that nature. And you did talk about the fact that he was at Kansas. This is a guy who spent a lot of time there, you know, from 1998 to 2009 and then 2012 to 2019. So he's really just an institution as far as being a Jayhawk. But on the positive side, not to be all gloom and doom, I think it's always good when you have someone who has familiarity with the program and the area. Now, I think it's something that's key. As you mentioned it, he held this job at the beginning of the decade, closer to 2010. And North Texas football changed a lot since 2010, you know, in the 10 years since under Seth Luttrell. So yes, he has that familiarity, but it's also not the same program he left. Excuse me, he was there in 2011, so I just want to clarify that. But it's not the same program he left. So I think it'll be an adjustment period for him. And I think this is really pivotal. You know, I think this year, and I don't want to get too into a season previews, but I think all these coaching changes really matter for North Texas, because I think this year is really pivotal for them, because Seth Luttrell, you and I talked about, is a guy who we thought that might be on his way out the door to a P5 job if, you know, the right year lined up. And now we just have to see what they can put together as far as, you know, the year following the Mason Fine era.
Definitely. In a post-Mason Fine world, certainly excited to see how this program responds. And like you mentioned, there's a lot riding on the success of that program in terms of Seth Luttrell's future as a college football coach, and as well as his coordinators. So I think you got to imagine everybody's coming into this season with, you know, they're going to lay it all on the line and come in guns a-blazing. So we'll see how this goes, I guess. Staying within the state of Texas, new defensive coordinator for UTSA, Mr. Tyrone Nix, is set to take that job with the Roadrunners. If you don't remember him, he used to be the linebackers coach at Ole Miss last season. And of course, with the introduction of their new head coach, Lane Kiffin, he was apparently not interested in keeping him. So I'm interested to see how this goes. I feel like anytime you have a P5 position coach come to the G5 and take over a coordinator position, there's always a pretty high learning curve. So, you know, I feel like he definitely got to see a lot of high-powered offenses within the SEC. So I feel like that's only going to be able to benefit him in terms of how he passes on that knowledge to his players. But at the same time, it's two completely different jobs. So I'm interested to see how he handles this.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we talk about, you know, the younger coaches and things of that nature. One thing I am a huge believer on, and not that Nix is a younger guy, you know, he's in his 40s. He took his first coordinator job at 29 years old in 2001. So you do the math, 19 years, you know, he's almost 50. But one thing I am a fan of is if you are getting your first head coaching job, which UTSA head coach Jeff Traylor is, I like the idea of surrounding yourself with guys who are veterans. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be older. It just means that they have a ton of coaching experience. I think that is key, because I kind of remember Scott Frost's first year at UCF, which they went 6-7, but he surrounded himself with a lot of guys who he knew. But that team, and now granted, you know, the program's exploded and they had a great year in 2017, but that team had a lot of issues, or I won't say a lot, but they had a fair amount of issues just on the field game day things, because a lot of those guys were all first-time coordinators. You know, Frost was a first-time head coach. Troy Walters was a first-time offensive coordinator. And the defensive coordinator who's escaping me right now, who's at Nebraska, I'm forgetting his name. But he was a first-time defensive coordinator. So I definitely am a fan of, if you're getting your first head coaching job, definitely surrounding yourself with maybe more veteran coordinators. I think that'll kind of ease the transition. So I think it's a solid hire.
Yeah, you know, like I mentioned, there's going to be a learning curve there from going from position coach to coordinator. But since he already has that experience, definitely will make it easier on him. And I completely agree with what you said. I like that Jeff Traylor is surrounding himself with experienced assistant coaches who know a thing or two, have seen a thing or two. And I think that's a really smart way to, you know, build a program and build a staff. So I feel like UTSA, all things considered, are definitely heading in the right direction. In that vein, curious things happening on the UTSA Twitter sphere. Frank Wilson, of course, no longer the head coach of the Roadrunners. He is now the head coach at McNeese State at the FCS level. And he got a little bit of negative attention from UTSA fans recently. In his intro presser at McNeese State, he said, "I'm happy to be at McNeese State because this program has," I'm paraphrasing, but this program has good tradition and a lot of pride in the program, something which my previous job did not have. And understandably, made some folks a little bit upset. Now, you did have some examples of, you know, former coaches and staffers saying, you know, it's all good. Don't think there was anything malicious about it. But also you did have Lorenzo Dantzler, who also was UTSA's arguably one of their better defensive players last season, basically tweeted, you know, good riddance, felt like we got outcoached multiple times by teams that were less talented than them during Frank Wilson's tenure there. So, you know, I definitely a weird way to, you know, diss your former employer at your new job, I think. And I don't know, personally, like, sure, I guess like McNeese State has technically like won more conference championships than UTSA, but that's because they're a significantly older program. So it's I don't know, it was just a weird jab, I guess, to take it at UTSA's program as a whole. What did you think about that?
Yeah, so I definitely thought it was interesting because maybe I'm more familiar with McNeese State in the sense that they're an FCS program who actually used to have kind of a weird rivalry with USF, my hometown team here in Tampa, when USF back in the day was an FCS team. So maybe I'm just more familiar with them. And for Frank Wilson to say that they have more of a history and tradition of winning, more of a tradition, I want to misquote him, more of a tradition per se. Yeah, I mean, once again, like you said, I think that's just more of a, has more to do with the fact that their first season was 1940 than them being some sort of, you know, powerhouse in the sense that this team hasn't been Division I since, I believe, 1981. And they haven't been a great, you know, FCS team. I mean, they've been okay. They've had up and down years, but, I don't want to, by any stretch of imagination, they're not like, you know, a North Dakota State, a team that's coming in having won, you know, like six of the last eight FCS national championships or anything like that. So I thought it was a weird jab by Frank Wilson and maybe unintended. But then I think the quote from Lorenzo Dantzler is more telling because, and I don't know how you feel about this, I'll ask you really quick after I finish. I think UTSA has been a talented team over the past 2 years. I mean, Frank Wilson made his name on being a really good recruiter. There hasn't been any question. I'd be interested to ask, you know, Greg Luca from the San Antonio News Express or maybe our own Jared Kalmus' question as well, is to their assertion or their assessment of UTSA's talent as well. Because I don't think anyone doubts that they've been talented. They've had struggles at the quarterback position. We know part of that's been due to injury. But I don't think anyone would say that, you know, they're like a UTEP, for example, in which they're just really trying to build from the ground up. So I'll just ask you, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, UTSA has had a lot of talent over the last couple of years that just could never quite put it together. You know, I can only really remember like one or two instances of like play calling or, you know, that sort of thing over Frank Wilson's tenure where I was like, yep, that's what lost them that game. But, you know, I feel like the players would definitely have a better, you know, perspective of whether or not they were outcoached or not in those kind of situations. Like, you know, I don't think it's hard to go back and find a lot of examples of, you know, when a coach gets fired and players will, you know, very quickly take to social media or whatever to be like, you know, still love the guy, felt like he was a great coach. It just didn't quite come together. But when you have players going like, yeah, no, it was definitely him. Like I feel like that's pretty telling because as much as, you know, you want to say like people want to place the blame on people other than themselves, I feel like it's pretty rare within college football to find players who will actively take to social media like this instance to call out a former coach. You know what I mean? So yeah, I feel like it's, while, you know, I can't really point to specific examples other than once or twice in Frank Wilson's tenure where I thought, yes, his team got outcoached here, I think it's pretty telling that this kind of thing's happening.
Yeah, I definitely would agree. And you made a really good point about the fact that this isn't something you see from players a lot. You know, most times when coaches leave or players leave, you get the generic, you know, hey, love that guy, hey, thanks. Or, you know, and I shouldn't say it's generic because I know sometimes – you know, that's really well intended and definitely meant wholeheartedly. But you don't see this, which is, you know, going out of the way to say, hey, yeah, we were outcoached. So I think that is telling, especially from a current player. And a really good one, too, a Lorenzo Dantzler at that. So,
yeah, so it seems like everybody's kind of moving on to greener pastures within that situation. So certainly interesting that it's, you know, kind of coming to – not necessarily an end, but it's interesting how we got here in retrospect. And then staying within CUSA West, one more change I want to get to in this episode. And this one feels pretty significant, actually. Southern Miss, that offense, we talked a lot about that offense throughout the course of the last two seasons. And while they were inconsistent, there were times where they looked damn near unstoppable with Kez Watkins, Jack Abraham, et cetera. But they are losing offensive coordinator Buster Faulkner as he moves on to the University of Georgia to be the head of offensive quality control. So, yeah, like I mentioned, this feels pretty significant for Jay Hobson in that he clearly had a guy who had a lot of positive momentum going on that offensive side of the ball and was clearly what, you know, put that team in the position to be right there in the running for CUSA West towards the end of last year. And then, of course, stubbed their toe and couldn't get the job done. But yeah, I feel like anytime you lose somebody like Faulkner, who's in charge of a high powered offense, that's definitely going to slow you down at least somewhat. So I'm interested to see how they respond to this situation.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, this is one that we talked about, kind of did our own version of a very special episode, you know, last year when we talked about the fact that Southern Miss entertained the idea of hiring Art Briles, just to kind of show you how, for lack of a better term, desperate that, you know, Jay Hobson was to really kind of jumpstart that offense and get them going in the right direction. And they kind of stumbled into Buster Faulkner because he was the person who came in directly after the whole Art Briles controversy and did a really good job with that offense, specifically quarterback Jack Abraham. And the one thing you saw with him is that he kind of opened up that offense, that allowed Abraham to push the ball down the field more. And that's been the thing that if you look at his completion percentage in 2018, you know, it was completed, I want to say he led FBS in completion percentage, completed 73.1% of his passes. This year that came down to 67%, but 67% isn't a bad number. You're still completing the ball at a very high clip. And his yards per throw, and I'm doing, you know, reciting these numbers off of memory here, so forgive me if I'm off a tick or two, but I believe his yards per attempt went up about a yard and a half, which is a significant difference. I want to say it was something like 7.2 or 7.3 to 8.8 or 8.9. So yeah, the fact that they were pushing the ball downfield with the dangerous weapons like Quez Watkins or, you know, Jalen Adams or guys like that, I think that is kind of going to be a huge loss. You know, it'd be interesting to see if they have an offensive coordinator who's going to have that same philosophy. He's going to say, hey, you know, yeah, we can dink and dunk our way down and maybe that, you know, the numbers will look good per se, but I don't think there's any doubt that this offense really opened up under Faulkner. Or we can have someone who's going to say, hey, I got one of the best quarterbacks in Conference USA and let me push the ball downfield and really take shots. And I think that, you know, not to say that Jay Hobson by any stretch of imagination has been playing things conservative, but we know it's the one thing that's left for Southern Miss and it's really eating at Golden Eagle fans for the past how many years. It's that they're tired of being, you know, 6-6, 7-5. When can they take that next step and compete for CUSA West? So I think this hire that hasn't been made yet, it will be really crucial.
Certainly so. I mean, you hit the nail on the head with how good that offense has been the last couple of years. So whoever they get to take over this role is going to have a tall task to complete and big shoes to fill. So Eric talked a lot about all the different offensive coaching changes that are happening over the course of this year. Of all the coaching changes that we've talked about today, which of these changes feels most significant to you in the grand scheme of things?
I think there's two or three, and I know, you know, I'm kind of, you know, hedging my bets here by taking a few, but if I had to rank them 1 through 3, I would look at Southern Miss just because they're most in contention to win right now. I think you could say, sure, that FAU and their coaching changes, you want to see how those things are going to happen, but it's an entirely new staff. So that's, you know, not just one change. So I would definitely put that Southern Miss, you know, put Southern Miss first, considering the fact that you and I both believe that the pieces are there. So there's that. And then I think you got to take it to probably Charlotte, because we know that, you know, Chris Reynolds is there and really his development is really key for that program and them taking the next step. So I think that getting that offensive coordinator position right with Chris Reynolds and, you know, the development of the receivers, Victor Tucker, you know, Trey Harbison coming in at running back at Charlotte, there's no doubt that they exceeded some expectations. I mean, I was very high on them coming into this year, but I think they have a chance to surprise people again and maybe take that next step and contend for a CUSA East title. So getting that higher, right. And then the last one I'll say would be Louisiana Tech, because Tech as well is a team that, you know, is coming off of a really good year and kind of replacing Bob Diaco, or excuse me, not kind of, they did have to replace Bob Diaco. That one's going to be huge as well, because we know that while he was only there for 1 year, he's a heck of an assistant. So I think that'll be one as far as getting that one right, 1 through 3, that's how I'd rank him.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I'm hesitant to say Southern Miss is the most significant just because, like, I don't feel like we technically know the significance of this until we know who's going to take over that job. You know what I mean? So for that reason, I think I'm going to say the most significant one was David Blackwell coming in to Louisiana Tech, because just look at the success this program's had in the last few years. 5 straight bowl wins. I feel like the offense, you know, I feel like they've still got a few more decent years left of the talent that's already on that side of the ball. And, you know, for as good as that defense has been with, you know, guys in the recent years like Jalen Ferguson and Meek Robertson, I'm really, really curious to see how David Blackwell lives up to, you know, the example that Bob Diaco and the previous coordinator set with the just really solid record that they posted in the last couple of years. So I feel like we're in the same boat talking about, you know, how good or how good that move could potentially be or how bad it could be. You know, it's going to be, I think all these coordinators have really big shoes to fill, but I feel like Blackwell, you know, most has to get some big feet very quickly, so to speak.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, but so we talked about Louisiana Tech this year and the fact that, you know, we've labored on it, you know, ad nauseum on this podcast. They were right there. I don't think there's any doubt that had they not had those suspensions, they would have won Conference USA's West Division. So it'd be interesting to see the fact that they had some significant turnover in 2020, how this defensive coordinator spot refilled and how the rest of their, you know, roster refilled as well. But I think that one definitely is a one worth watching.
Man, Tech fans are going to have nightmares about that loss to Marshall for years to come, aren't they? If Tech somehow doesn't win a COSA title in the next, you know, few years, they're going to come back to those suspensions and that loss to Marshall and think, what could have been? Man, I've thought about that a lot over the course of the offseason, how close they were to not just getting back to the COSA championship game, but they had a legit shot to win the whole thing if with just the way Jamar Smith was playing, how you know, the way Adrian Hardy was playing, you know, all the puzzle pieces were right there and they just couldn't fit it all together right at the very end. So tough break for the Bulldogs, but still got 5 straight bowl wins, I guess.
Yeah, really quick, you know, before we wrap up the episode, I guess, and then once again, I don't want to take it, you know, get into our season preview or anything like that, but I think I have a perfect example covering FIU. They had a chance to clinch Conference USA's East Division in 2018, last game of the year against Marshall at home. They trip up and lose, and a lot of the players talked about that carrying into the 2019 season. So that'll be worth keeping an eye on, you know, especially the fact that they have the turnover and the coaching changes. Is that something that kind of lingers, or how is Skip Holtz going to be able to tell those guys, hey, last year's last year, it's done. And I think what really helps them is the fact that they're coming off a good win against a, you know, a Miami program that, sure, it's not the Miami of old, but it's a P5 win. But that's just something to keep an eye on, because I saw that firsthand at FIU where some of the players in a private moment will say, hey, we just couldn't shake off Marshall.
Yeah, you know, like I mentioned, I think a lot of people are going to be thinking about that for years to come. So hopefully they can kind of put the pieces back together. With this Blackwell signing and this really good recruiting class that they got coming in. But that will probably be the subject of our next episode with the conclusion of the signing period right around the corner. So come on back for that. Thank you all so much for listening once again. If you haven't already, just subscribe on Apple Podcasts already. We're also on Spotify. Check us out there. If you have time, leave a review. That definitely helps the show grow. And of course, check out underdogdynasty.com every day for more G5 football goodness. If you're on the social media stuff, check us out on Twitter at underdogdynasty. I'm at @JoeHio_. Eric is at @EricCHenry_. Got plenty more to talk about in the coming months. And of course, NFL draft around the corner, signing period, like I mentioned, and got a feeling we're going to have one or two more coaching changes to deal with. So talk to you next time, everybody. Happy football watching.